that subject. So my new title is Neuroscience, Techno-Spectacularism and the Mind. And I think after Nicholas Rose's keynote this morning, it's only an issue that's going to get more important. So we are living in an age of technological spectacularism with no apparent limit to the scope of sensational hyperbolic claims about science and technology. At the same time, the pendulous swing between ultimate utopian promise and apocalyptic dystopian threat has left us without either the time or the taste for nuanced description of causes and effects. So with this context in mind, I'll now examine the recent exponential explosion of popular and scholarly interest in the field of neuroscience, and in particular, the search for an explanation for the phenomena of mind. It's a particularly important search for the implications it brings to bear on the status and existence of that historically most popular locus of knowledge, the individual subject. In this paper, I'll discuss the work of American neuroscientist William Uttle and the thesis of his book, Neural Theories of Mind, provocatively subtitled, Why the Mind-Brain Problem May Never Be Solved, which is the key thing. And in that book, he forwards the argument that the promised explanation for how the brain produces the mind may never actually be forthcoming. So I'm going to outline Uttle's reasons for his claims of intractability, claims which include some decidedly hard science limits, but I also wanted to end issues of research and misconceptions and overenthusiasm. But I want to particularly draw your attention to the consequences of his work. If Uttle is correct, we're left with a serious epistemological problem. How do we answer the question of who or what actually exists with the capacity to know, without resorting, of course, to dogmatism? So while a number of proposed answers to this question fail to escape the same problems Uttle outlines, there is a fruitful current running through contemporary philosophy that provides a useful new direction. So the philosopher-scientist duo of Andy Clark and David Chalmers propose a radically different definition of mind, such that we can conceive of it as an extended mind, involving the brain, the body, and objects and devices in the world as one big part of the cognitive system. So think about how we outsource mental arithmetic to devices and the button presses and numerical readouts. Clark and Chalmers say that we can include that in the mind. So this is a reversal of the prevailing inward trend to reduction and atomization that is indicative of a deeper current, one that attempts to recast the scope of philosophy, the object of philosophy, such that it shines back out onto the world and all of the things in it, be they brains, bugs, or steam trains. And I'll conclude by suggesting that the stuff of the mind is not just the stuff of the brain, but any stuff at all that can be associated, translated, or actor-networked with the mind. So a few weeks ago, my girlfriend told me something rather peculiar. According to her, I grind my teeth in my sleep, and not just occasionally, but to such an extent that it actually wakes her up 5 to 10 times a night. At first, I struggled to believe her. Surely I'd know or remember if I was doing something like that, even in my sleep. But then I noticed how stiff and sore my jaw was in the morning, and I remembered the last time I'd been to the dentist, he'd asked me whether I grind my teeth, and I replied in the negative. More recently, my poor sleep-deprived girlfriend has informed me that she's been doing things to me in my sleep to try and stop me grinding. So giving me gentle massages, just telling me to stop and open my mouth. Apparently, I'm not quite responsive in this sort of mode. I'll do what she says. And all of it I have absolutely no recollection of. I wake up and I just have a normal night's sleep. So clearly, I really don't get how my own mind works. But then, according to William Uttle, the experience is somewhat universal. He says of himself and his fellow neuroscientists, we really do not yet have the barest glimmerings of how the brain produces the mind. But how can this be, given the plethora of popular neuroscientific publications and the credulity with which they're marketed, presented, and sold around the world? So these books are not being written by charlatans and snake oil salesmen, as many of them are scientists, academics, and journalists who regularly appear on TV shows and give impressively attended TED Talks and frequently discuss the subject in the media. Many recent bestsellers belong to an emerging genre that could be somewhat cynically described as neuroscience and X, boasting scores of miraculous assertions regarding the promise of neuroscientific developments that pertain to this or that field of study. But there are problems and conflicts under the seemingly calm waters of neuroscientific consensus, as Nicholas Rose kind of hinted at this morning. A serious issue with the field is highlighted by acclaimed neuroscientific pioneer Michael Gazzaniga, who's paraphrasing an article in Nature saying that neuroscientists sometimes have misconceptions about their own field. Even more worrying for those of us outside the immediate scientific community is the following. by the scientist and author Jason Zevin, who makes a startling assertion about the difficulty faced by neuroscientists trying to do work. He says that as scientists, we learn to live with the fact that much of our work is highly subjective. There's actually very little that any two people who call themselves cognitive neuroscientists are guaranteed to agree on. Mostly we make progress by choosing the side of an argument that seems most plausible given our pre-theoretical commitments and try to provide data that would convince someone starting from the other side. This is very nearly tantamount to an admission of guilt. Picking a side of an argument and looking for proof, pre-theoretical commitments, where's the so-called veil of objectivity and certainty with which many neuroscientists claim, many neuroscientific claims are thrown around or wielded cudgel-like against naive enemies? So we're in dangerous waters, and as any psychologist well-versed in mental biases will attest. Thankfully, then, William Uttle, a neuroscientist and professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Michigan, with a string of publications dating back to the early 70s, has attacked some of the more outstanding problems with the field. In an extremely revealing passage from his book, Neural Theories of Mind, Uttle states that classic neuroscientific history is filled with allusions to hydraulic, telephonic, and telegraphic stimulants to theoretical ingenuity. The traditional serial computer became the metaphor of choice for those who supported a theory of mind made up of independent cognitive modules. Network approaches obviously sprouted from the work on parallel logic circuits carried out during World War II. The point is that whenever a new technology emerged, a new theory of the relationship between the brain and the mind was born. This effect was particularly noticeable whenever a new technology, for example, EEGs, microelectrode recordings, or brain scannings, provided a novel means of examining the workings of the brain. So far from it being detached empiricists, toiling away to uncover secret truths with neither preconception nor prejudice, instead Uttle says that available technology inordinately determines theoretical concepts of the mind-brain relationship. Small wonder, then, that when it comes to dealing with impossibility, the field is shot through with the techno-spectacular assumptions of boundless progress or potential. And this is in stark contrast to the physical sciences, which long ago accepted the existence of hard limits and impassable boundaries, such as the speed of light or the laws of thermodynamics and the conservation of energy. But again, with the recent findings of the particle accelerator in CERN, we're seeing even that sort of being questioned, and it's like, oh, maybe everything is possible again. So that's just a weird thing. So Uttle Riley adds that one wonders why there is such reluctance to accept that there are going to be equally profound and yet equally fruitful limits in the mind-brain sciences. But Uttle doesn't limit himself to criticising attitudes. As a neuroscientist himself, he spends the majority of his book discussing why the mind-brain problem may be an utterly intractable one. Accordingly, Uttle says it turns on one's personal answer to another fundamental question, which is what is the essential level of psychoneural equivalence? That is, where among all possible responses one could measure in the brain should one look for the true processes that indisputably account for mental activity? In his book, Uttle helpfully outlines the three main forms current explanations take, labelling them broadly as field theories, single neuron theories, and network theories. And while the first two have generally gone out of vogue, the third is still extremely prevalent. Network theories attempt a reduction of the mind to the structural arrangement of neuronal interconnections, which are complex and irregular to the point of inscrutability. It is in this network, tangled and thorny beyond the wildest, most fevered dreams of the most brilliant computer architect, that the mind, Uttle says, is most likely to be embodied. His concern with the current preferred explanations, however, are many, even though the hypothesis supporting them is probably genuinely correct. The main concern for our purposes is actually a pragmatic issue rooted in mathematics and the nature of simulating or computing the kinds of networks involved in the brain. Uttle says that for a psychologically realistic network, the number of variables is so large the simulation problem becomes intractable or unsolvable for practical rather than theoretical reasons. That is, although there may be no intrinsic barrier to the solution of a given problem, it would take what is effectively an infinite amount of time to solve it. Now, while it's tempting to believe that as computers get faster, some of these practical barriers may be overcome, but on the contrary, that kind of attitude is exactly what Uttle is criticising. According to him, far simpler tasks have been shown to be utterly unsolvable. Therefore, there is no reason other than a kind of naive optimism to hope that the tools we have or will have are going to be capable of solving the mind-brain problem. But there are also a great deal many theoretical issues that Uttle raises with explanations of this type. And while time does not really permit their examination here, he concludes this discussion with what I consider to be the final nail in the coffin of reductive network explanations. Arnold describes the situation as an emerging super complexity that means there is no hope of a complete neural network theory with available or conceivable network analysis methods. It is an unpopular truth to assert in this period of technological spectacularism, but it will do us no good to ignore, and as previously mentioned, Arnold suggests it may prove ultimately more fruitful to acknowledge these limits. So we're at something of an impasse. We cannot reliably expect neuroscience to tell us what the mind is, located precisely in a certain area, structure, field, or pattern of activation within the brain. And as a result, some scientist philosophers such as Paul and Patricia Churchland, as well as Thomas Metzinger, have taken the problem to its very extreme, rejecting altogether the very existence of mind. Discussion of the relative merits or otherwise of the philosophical positions of Metzinger and Churchland is kind of beyond the scope of this paper, but importantly, I feel it is moving entirely the wrong direction. A better one is found in two places. First, in the work of Andy Clark and David Chalmers, who have argued for an active externalism that redraws the boundaries of mind out beyond the cranial cavity. And secondly, in an emerging current of philosophy that recasts the spotlight of philosophical reflection onto objects. So for Clark and Chalmers, if a process performed inside the brain counts as cognitive, for example, mental arithmetic is my example earlier, then the same process happening outside of it should also count. The late Terry Dartnell, a cognitive scientist formerly of Griffith University, explains this as the mind leaking into the world. It follows in the tradition of Plato's denouncement of the technology of writing for fear it will take the place of memory. And there is a kind of truth to his assessment, even if his worries proved rather misdirected. To further illustrate, Dartnell explains Clark and Chalmers' example of Otto, the Alzheimer's sufferer. Otto hears that there is an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. He consults his notebook, which says that the museum is on 53rd Street. He walks to 53rd Street and goes to the museum. Clark and Chalmers say that the notebook plays the same role for Otto that biological memory plays for the rest of us. It just so happens that this information lies beyond the skin. So what I conclude from Clark and Chalmers' active externalism is that the stuff of the mind is different from the stuff of the brain. To be clear, there's a strange double action at work here, an action that seems at first suspiciously like the invocation of supernatural explanations, but are current in contemporary philosophy labelled variously as either the speculative realist movement or object-oriented ontology can help us think through the difficulties of the mind as an object. Summarising the events of a conference held at the University of West England, Bristol, Mark Fisher explained why the philosopher Graham Harman, a founding figure in object-oriented philosophy, rejected traditional materialism. The tendency in materialism, Harman claimed, is always to dissolve specific objects, reducing them either to smaller physical entities or see them as ephemeral products of an underlying monist hypernature. So this is where we part ways with Arnold, who characterises philosophical monism as the basic philosophical stance without which cognitive neuroscience would be nonsensical. The important point of difference is that object-oriented philosophers feel it is possible to lay aside materialism while holding on to one's realism. Graham Harman bases his philosophical take on objects on a unique reading of Heidegger's discussion of the tool, which argues that it is actually an ontological argument. Harman says that equipment, in Heidegger's sense, is global. Beings are tool beings, since there's no fundamental distinction between the tool as an object of intention and as an object in itself. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but I'm not well-versed enough in either Heidegger or Harman's work to really like explain it better than that. I recommend really looking it up. It's quite good. But he makes the following example that I think is quite illustrative. What saves the bridge from being a mere pile of iron and asphalt is not the fact that people find it convenient, but the fact that any pile of anything exerts some sort of reality in the cosmos, altering the landscape of being in some distinct way. Natural mountain passes and other obstacles have no less equipmentality than an artificial tunnel. The key to the tool analysis is not that it undermines the notion of solid Newtonian blocks with people-centred analysis of plants and projections. The key is that it shows us that descriptions of the object as solid material and descriptions of it as functionally useful are derivative. From unfathomably small quarks to unbearably large quasars, object-oriented philosophers assert that objects exist of all shapes and sizes across all layers of reality. According to this remarkable perspective, then, the materialism of neuroscience is an equally derivative description of pre-existing object reality, or tool being, to use Harman's phrase, in much the same way that, for instance, a psychologically descriptive model of my nighttime teeth grinding is derivative. It seems like an unacceptably strange position. We're told by scientific materialism that, after all, things are made up of smaller things. And materialist debunking operates in a downward fashion. And all things are made up of smaller things, producing ever smaller bits and pieces of shrapnel as things are exploded into ever smaller little bits. So it's not, you don't have a brain, you've got neurons. You don't have neurons, you have atoms. You don't have atoms, you have protons and electrons. You don't have protons and electrons, you have quarks and gluons, and quarks and gluons come in six different exciting varieties, and it's sort of like, where's the end to it? So there's something familiar in this move that is quite reminiscent of what Bruno Latour described in his famous paper, Why Has Critique Run Out of Steam? For the type of critic Latour is addressing, real causes are always just out of reach for naive believers. Meanwhile, our own cherished causes remain ready to hand. To reverse the old axiom, for materialism, there's always a smaller fish. Yes, it's true, you totally got me. Things are made out of other things, but somehow it's equally true that the thing is also the thing itself. Or to put it slightly differently, the reality of the thing is just as much made up of however other things contact it, perceive it, resist it, or perturb it. The bucket is nails, solder, metal, and paint for the engineer designing it. But it's also a bucket to the labourer who fills it with sand, and it's to the ground which it rests upon, it's a weight to be resisted. It's parts and wholes. So if this seems far-fetched, consider for a moment the distinguished history of far-fetched ideas. Before Einstein, we thought that time and space were unrelated. Before quantum physics, we thought that the atom was the smallest, most elementary particle. Before Galileo, we thought the sun revolved around the Earth. So why is the present perspective so privileged? Why would we have it all figured out by now? Are we really so jaded by techno-spectacularism that we are unfazed by the weirdness of the world? The world is strange. Things are strange. Objects are strange. The mind is an object. To close with an anecdote from the 2009 film Pontypool, it tells the story of a zombie-like outbreak in the rural Canadian town of the same name. It puts a different spin on the traditional zombie outbreak by having the virus not be transmitted by air or bodily fluids, as in most films of the genre. Instead, the virus affects the very words of the English language itself. Or at least that's the way the film explains it to us. But even if the film believes this, it's not quite so simple, for it's not as if the words themselves have gained some new power of infection. Instead, it's a combination of the word and the individual's brain, meaning that the only etiologic explanation for the Pontypool virus is that it is infecting the mind object itself. The film makes a number of allusions to the virus's existence being quite different from our own. It's never materially manifest, you only ever see the symptoms of getting sick. And it's a well-known tactic to seclude the object of horror from sight. In this instance, its very immateriality allows us to think objects, as well as giving the virus additional purchase within our minds and our mind objects themselves. Perhaps the real infectiousness of the Pontypool virus is measured by the fact that I'm mentioning it to you now, in the real world. So the virus has jumped from fiction and infected my mind, and I'm sort of disseminating it even further. So that's it. Thank you.
Within the context, the kind of different context that you put together there, I'm just wondering if you see any problem in that whole extended mind concept, insofar as with what you sort of posited as a kind of ineradicable mystery, to take the term Nick Rose was talking about this morning, to the mind and its workings and operations, by thinking about, you know, also your iPhone as part of something that you're still going to call mind, it can never actually contain that ineffability. So there's necessarily a kind of analogical disjunct between the two things that you're positing on the same term.
When you say it can't contain that ineffability, why do you say that?
Well, it's totally explainable in terms of its operations and algorithms and material, in a way that what you all say about the mind isn't.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and again, it's hard not to be sort of all positive and chirpy about, you know, future prospects of neuroscience. But it's sort of, how completely can we ever really explain anything? not to get all postmodern, oh, everything's all nothing, but like there's always, this is the point Graham Harman makes about objects, is that there's always some hidden reserve left away. So even though we're describing the materiality of it, Graham Harman would suggest that the actual iPhone object itself, well, like what am I engaging with it at the moment? At the moment I'm engaging with it as sort of a discourse, as sort of like a, you know, the things around the iPhone that have sort of accumulated in public knowledge, you know, that's made in China, that it's assembled by slave labourers, that it's designed by a genius, Steve Jobs. But as soon as I pick it up and hold it in my hands, it's like my fingers are touching it and they're not engaging it. Then no, you never really exhaust the full object, if that makes sense. So in that sense, I think the ineffability actually is there. I think it still is in everything. If, you know, if we believe Harman and the and those dudes.
I don't really know enough about this, but I'm just surprised that you can use the mind as an object in relation to Harman's work. Because I always thought the whole point about his work that the objects are autonomous. You can never exhaust your understanding of their relational effects, but yeah, they will always be an autonomous entity. Whereas the mind seems to me to be an abstract entity. So it's not, it doesn't have that autonomy that Harman talks about.
He's
talking about objects.
I suppose so, but I mean, I guess how much of that is just an illusion of the, like, the, we have control over our own minds. I mean, you just have to look at like the history of mental illness to know that like, we don't have control over our own minds. They do their own things, and I'm not my mind. Like, that's not who I am. I mean, I'm all sorts of different.
But isn't that the whole point of separating the mind from the brain? That you move, that you have, that you're making a distinction between a material entity and something else, and that's why. I mean, I can imagine your argument to relate via Harman to the brain, but I don't understand how you can relate it to mind.
Well, I guess so. You have to believe in the extended mind thesis first, that you can couple, you know, external objects with brain processes. And yeah, no, I totally admit that it's not like a perfect thesis. It's not completely defensible. There are, you know, holes everywhere. But I think the usefulness of thinking of the mind as an object is that it, I mean, it means that we can kind of, it gives us kind of a purchase from which to avoid being either, oh, it's all determined by materialism, or it's all unknowable. It's sort of like it's some. I don't really know. It's sort of, it's really new territory for me. I'm not like a scientist. I have like an interest in science. Like I did a music degree and I'm now doing a PhD in like internet communities. So it's very much sort of like I'm a real beginner in this sort of area. Yeah, I don't know how to answer the question, unfortunately. Sorry.
Any other questions?
Can I just ask, is it not your, are you not noticing a trend in the readings in neuroscience that you're doing, that the category of mind itself is one that is rapidly disappearing from neuroscience discussions, and in fact has been taken over by the category of the brain, so that a lot of the, you know, the work in neuroscience is looking for explanations in the biology of the
yes.
brain that
yep.
we would formerly have attributed to the activities of the mind. So are you finding that, in fact, the mind-brain distinction is actually just vanishing from these experiences?
So I mentioned Patricia Churchland, Paul and Patricia Churchland, who are two main theorists in sort of a movement in neuroscience, neurophilosophy, really. And they come under the heading of what's called eliminative materialists. So basically they think that as soon as we get to the point of being able to explain the brain and completely understand all of its workings and functions, we won't find that the mind exists. We'll just find chemical processes, or we'll find the operation of neural networks, or we'll find patterns of, I think their phrase is patterns of vector activation outside of weight space or something, you know, some really bizarre abstract term. But again, I think that like you can only really believe in that if you're willing to sort of make that leap between present science and like all future speculation. And what's really troubling in that act is not that like that's what they're doing, it's that it's never really acknowledged that that's a speculative thing. Like they say, as soon as completed neuroscience. Well, maybe the idea of completed neuroscience is a fallacy in itself. Like, I don't know. I mean, that was what Nick Rose was saying this morning. The more we realize, the more we realize we know so little. And that's not to say that it won't, as we go along, you know, make huge reconfigurations of things like mind. But I guess I don't see mind disappearing as a useful thing, as a useful object, basically. But that's just my opinion, so...
Cool. We might have to leave it there because we're getting behind time.